Welcome to Awaken Calls. Every Saturday, we host conversations with guest speakers from all walks of life. Speakers whose personal journeys awaken and inspire our innate spirit of service. Thank you for coming together to plant seeds for a more compassionate society.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening. My name is Rahul, and I'm your host for our weekly Global Awaken Call. Thank you all for joining us. The purpose of these calls is really to share stories that really help us plant seeds of a more compassionate society while fostering our own inner transformation. We do this by holding collective conversations with guest speakers from all walks of life who inspire us through their actions to live in a more service-oriented way. Behind these calls is an entire ecosystem of service-based volunteers whose invisible work allows us to hold this space. Today, our special guest is none other than Mushima Ikeda, who really embodies the theme today of the vow of not to burn out. Thanks again for joining our call. Let's start with a minute of silence to anchor ourselves. Thank you, and welcome again to our weekly Awaken Call, today in conversation with Mushim. So here's how the call's going to work. In just a few moments, our moderator, Birju Bandya, is going to engage in a deep dialogue with our speaker, Mushim. And at the top of the hour, we're going to roll into Q&A and the circle of sharing, where we invite all of your reflections and questions. The queue is currently open right now, so at any point, you can hit *6 on your phone, and you'll be prompted when it's your turn to speak. You can also email us comments or questions or reflections at ask@servicebase.org. Again, this week's theme is the vow to not burn out, and I will hand it over to Birju, who to me is a paragon of this virtue, working at the intersection of mindfulness and finance, who's obviously very active in the ecosystem as well on so many different fronts. So Birju, over to you.
Thank you so much, Rahul. I feel so excited, as you mentioned, one, because this is such a topic that's dear to my heart, and two, it feels like a complex one. But of course, the topic is a microcosm of a much larger conversation. And I'm very excited and grateful that we have as our guest today Mushim Patricia Ikeda. She is a teacher, an artist, and an activist with decades of experience. She's one of the senior leaders at East Bay Meditation Center in Oakland, California. She's a published poet, and she's worked tirelessly for the upliftment of the marginalized, whether that's in education, through inspiration, or otherwise. I was intrigued to see that she has guided month-long meditation retreats. She's received an honorary doctorate in sacred theology, and she's been the subject of multiple award-winning films on the topic of poetry and spirit-based activism. Mushim, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much. I'm really glad to be here in community with all of you who are on the phone right now and who are also just participating in this great work. Thank you.
Wonderful, wonderful. We'll just take this as a conversation and hopefully just dive deeper. And the theme is one of the aspects I'd love to explore, but I'd just love to get started with hearing how you're feeling today.
I'm feeling great. I hope you are.
Absolutely, absolutely. I just flew in from a flight yesterday, so I've got a little bit of a throat thing, so I apologize for any difficulty hearing.
No problem.
So I'd love to take our listeners through a bit of your journey and then work towards what most feels alive today, but I'd love to start at the beginning. And I noticed that you were born in Ohio and that your father was a U.S. soldier, and I'm just curious what that was like.
Thank you so much for asking. You know, Birju, I also work as a diversity and inclusion consultant.
Yes.
And there are the so-called dimensions of diversity or some of the major ways and then many, many other ways in which lines of difference are constructed and are perceived in among humans in our society. And something that I have to say, I just turned 63. My birthday is New Year's. And something that I've only become aware of in the past maybe 2 or 3 years is that I do come from a military family. And I never thought about myself that way because my father was not a career military man, although his younger brother, my Uncle George, was. However, the fact that my father, as a Nisei, or second-generation Japanese-American, so he was an American citizen. He was born in Colorado and grew up on a farm in Indiana and then was drafted into World War II. So the fact that he, as a Japanese-American, served in the U.S. Army, they did send him to Japan. He was put into the military intelligence unit as a translator, even though his spoken Japanese was so poor, since he never had a chance to go to Japanese school, that it was his first language, but he could never write Japanese. So here he is. He's a Japanese American. He's an American citizen. He's serving in the Army while being discriminated against, while Japanese Americans are being interned in camps, and he's drafted, so he has no choice. He has to go unless he had run away, which he didn't do. And along with all of these contradictions, and there he is in Japan, where he's never been to Japan before, and he's part of the American military, and he loves it. He found so many good things, so much structure, so many good friends, so much support for his education and development in the Army that really the military influenced his entire life in a very positive way. And so if you want to talk about going deeper, there's already a whole set of I'm sure that everyone on this call is, or many folks on this call are aware of how complex and intertwined that just even tiny bit of history is when we start thinking about our relationship to planting seeds for a compassionate society.
Yes. That was the rationale for my curiosity that we do value this perspective of ancestry, lineage, and context in shaping who we are at subtle levels. And of course, that's just a piece of your broader context. But I am curious how being in the Midwest, being a third-generation Japanese-American, having this kind of a ancestral lineage or fatherly lineage, it shaped and impacted your early journey.
Well, thanks for asking that. It feels very clear to me because there we were. Our family was located, I grew up, born in Cleveland, Ohio, and we grew up near Akron, Ohio, out in the countryside, kind of between Akron and Canton in Ohio. So it's a quasi-rural area that was, at that time in the 60s, there were the suburban housing developments were being built. It was an area very much in the midst of transition. It was during the time I was a little kid, during the time of the Cold War. So for those of you who are younger and who are not familiar with what that was, it was a period in the history of the United States in which there was constant fear that the main tension was between the United States and Russia. And there was constant fear that we were going to be nuclear bombed by Russia. And it was called the Cold War, I believe, because it was the threat. I mean, it wasn't a hot war. We weren't engaging. It was just this constant, incredible anxiety and fear of being nuked. And so as a very young child, I would go to school and we would have air raid drills to practice what we would do if we were nuclear bombed. And I always say, as a mother, little children are not any more stupid than anyone else. They just have less experience than adults. So we were a bunch of little kids, but we weren't dumb. I mean, we knew what was going on. I certainly did. And so that terror and that constant anxiety, that inability to have any control over the larger picture, led me very early on, definitely, it really hit me around third grade. When I was reading more, I was an early reader, and by third grade I was reading adult materials. And I just thought, well, all right then. So this is the kind of world that we live in which human beings would and have. I knew as a citizen of the United States that I was also part of the country that had nuclear bombed, had dropped the atom bomb on Japan. So I knew that was the world in which I lived, and I just thought, how can human beings be so cruel, be so destructive, so wantonly take life? These were weapons of mass destruction. And there I was. I'm a third grader near Akron, Ohio, and I would lie awake at night staring up at the ceiling, waiting to be bombed by Russia and incinerated, and thinking, how can this be? If there is a God in the universe, if there is a loving and all-knowing and compassionate God, why don't we get some help here? Why can't this be solved? My family was not Christian. So this basically just shows you that the what was happening in the world, what was happening in the United States, what my personal history was through my Japanese-American lineage, all came together to really right around third grade when I was doing a lot of reading and doing a lot of thinking. Is that's a time when I went through a spiritual crisis that was very deep. I couldn't really talk to anyone about it.
In third grade?
Yeah, I requested, yes, I know.
Wow.
I had an old friend, and he would look at family photos of me and starting from third grade. Before that, I always looked like a really, like, happy kid. And he, starting from third grade, he would say, there you are again, happy face. Because I would look so deeply depressed because I was in constant existential crisis in third grade and this constant political crisis. So that is really when my spiritual quest began, was in third grade. And it was very much tied up with issues of politics, of war, of aggression, and ultimately the spiritual question of how human beings can be so unthinking, so destructive, and so cruel to one another, as well as to the environment. Because, of course, the thing about nuclear bombs is that they kill not only people and animals, they also ruin the environment. And environmental concerns were coming up very strongly in the United States, again during the 60s, when Rachel Carson's book, Silent Spring, on the dangers
yes.
of DDT and pesticides came out. And my parents were very concerned with pesticides.
So I'm curious about this because to me, I mean, that's a very early stage to be asking these kinds of questions and the weight of these questions. But then as I understand it, you went into this period of life where your primary interest seemed to be moving towards literature and prose. And then, like, there came a point at which that didn't work anymore, if I understand correctly. And you went back into the depth of the spiritual inquiry. So I'm curious if I'm even understanding that right, or how did that emerge for you to become the primary focus?
Thanks for asking. You do get it right, and I feel very well understood, even though we've never met in person. Thank you very much for taking that interest. So what I would say when I look back is that there I am in Greensburg, Ohio, and my family, my mother, my father. I'm the oldest of three children. We were basically the only family of color in that the area where I grew up. Every once in a while, an African-American child would appear in school when I was in elementary school and then almost immediately disappear. I'm pretty sure, now I think it was an area probably in which there was KKK influence. Certainly it was not an area that was friendly to people of color. And so all of this, Japanese Americans, as many people know, at least during that time, were known as the model minority. And our family fit that description perfectly, at least on the outside. My parents, their primary value was education for all of their children. And we knew from the beginning that we didn't know how we would do it, but what our parents did was they both worked full-time from early on, and one of their primary focuses was for all of us to get college educations. And I remember my father saying he was not sparing in his analysis. And my mother grew up in Hawaii, where, as many, many of you probably know, white folks are called haoles, which I think it originally meant white foreigners in the Hawaiian indigenous language, and then grew to mean white people. And so my father used to say, you kids have got to be really smart. You've got to get really great educations. And he said, you are going to beat the haoles with your brains. He did. And that was our mandate. That was our mandate, is that we were going to be super brainy. We were going to be really brilliant, and we were going to excel in school, and that would be our way forward. That would be our path of liberation. And as a matter of fact, I joke that between my siblings and myself, we do have so many degrees that we have enough academic degrees for a much larger family. So we fulfill that. And for me, as a straight A student, as a kid, I really knew and I felt that my path was that really what was calling to me was poetry, was creative writing, and that was actually my path of liberation. And as soon as I learned how to write, which was, I guess, or print, was, I guess, in second grade or first grade. And so as soon as I learned how, I was an early reader, and as soon as I learned how to put words on paper, I wrote my first book. And I still have it. I think I have it in a box downstairs. It was on cheap paper, and I folded it up, and I made a little drawing of my brother and myself standing on a hill, and it was called The New Day. And here's how it went. So it's called The New Day. Once upon a time, there was a little girl and a little boy, and their names were Patty and Stevie. So that's me and my brother. And an old woman came along and said, do not open this box. And they did not, and so they lived happily. And I ran out of room, so I couldn't write ever after. So that was my first piece of writing, and as you can see, it is a reshaping, a retelling, a changing of the narrative of the myth of Pandora's box. So here we are, a strange old woman comes along, she gives us a mysterious box, says don't open it, and we're like, fine, we won't. And evil never comes into the world. So that was my very first piece of writing, And although I didn't have any analysis of that time, that's just what I was doing. These days we have a center for story-based, it's changing the narrative, social justice work through changing the narrative. I'm blanking out on the full name right now. Executive Director is Christine Cordero. Center for Story-Based Change, I believe. And there's so much talk about how we need to have a new story. We need to have many new stories. In this case, a story of what a compassionate society looks like, feels like, plays like, works like, solves conflicts like, what that is. And I already had started to do that from the very moment, first moment I took up my pencil. So when I...
If I could jump in, I'm really curious about this. So, one, I believe it's the Center for Story-Based Strategy, in case our listeners are interested in following up. But I'm also curious, so yes, there's that social justice or social change orientation towards the work, and so it wasn't like this kind of interest came out of left field. But as I understand it, you know, you got to a place where you moved into a monastery after having done all of your education in this space. So, I mean, how do you go from, say, I want to write about things that are socially minded to, all right, time to go in and live very much aligned with these deep values?
Thank you. So just to take that story thread forward, so then I go to undergraduate college. I did get some scholarships, and my parents had saved money for all of us, so I got my BA from Oberlin College in Ohio. It was at the time that was near the end of the Vietnam War, and Oberlin was known for its anti-war protests, for its progressive liberal arts, very activist social justice kind of education. I was a kid from rural Ohio. I just had no idea what I had landed in, and I floundered around quite a bit. And where I found my home was in the creative writing program. So I began writing poetry, which was not particularly geared towards issues of social justice. However, in the program, we were invited by our teachers to write about what we knew and to write about our grandparents, our families. And so I was recovering and reclaiming that lineage, which is, in fact, very social justice oriented, if we want to frame it that way. And I became successful. You know, once again, our parents' training to excel, and we've all been very fortunate in that, in my family, and that we are blessed with a great many talents. And that great teaching and support as well. And so, again, as an undergraduate student and immediately after graduation, I began publishing poetry. And I began teaching poetry writing. And so I was successful. I was on the track to become I was a published poet, to become a well-known and respected poet in the United States. I got my Master's of Fine Arts from the University of Iowa Graduate Writers Workshop, which has long been known as one of the most famous, if not the most famous, graduate writers program in the world. And it was during that time that I realized that there were so many things you said at the beginning, or Raul said, that we need to foster our own transformation while planting seeds for a compassionate society. And that's where it really came home to me, because I was part of artist circles of phenomenally talented people. I mean talented people, not just writers, but our circles had painters, playwrights, musicians. These were amazing artists in graduate school, and there was a huge amount of substance use and abuse. There was a lot of harmful sexual behavior. Many of our teachers were alcoholics and drug users, and it was all kind of normalized and encouraged within the service of art. And I just thought to myself, I'm not tough enough to do this. I'm not even physically strong enough to sustain this way of life. I will die. This is not good. And yet I had no idea of what some alternative would be. And it was really out of complete desperation. Again, I'm very good at floundering around. I will flounder. It's not pleasant, but I'll flounder and flounder, and I'll try different things, and I will reach out desperately. What about this? What about that? And so one of the resources that came up was reading about Zen Buddhism, which was connected also to, in philosophy, to the poetry, some of the poetry that I'd been reading in translation during my career as a poet. And I began reading all these books about Zen Buddhism, and I thought, okay, I'm really resonating with this. This seems to be a path that could help me become a happier and healthier person. And every book said the same thing. You've got to practice Zen meditation. Reading these books will be of no help whatsoever unless you find a teacher, unless you practice. So this was not 90%. 100% of the books on Zen say that, because it's a practice-oriented path. So I thought, well, all right, I'm in Iowa City. Where in the world would I find a Zen teacher or learn how to do Zen meditation? And immediately after graduate school, I moved to Ann Arbor, Michigan. I got a job as office manager of the Michigan Abortion Rights Action League in a totally kick-ass office. We were a tiny office, all grassroots, all women. These were incredible women activists. That was my introduction to activism and for women's reproductive rights. Which is I've been pro-choice throughout my life. And at the same time, so here I was doing great work. I was earning hardly any money. I had to take in typing to supplement, and I was not sustainable. I could barely pay my rent and food, and that was it. I was going nowhere in terms of financial sustainability. However, there was a Zen Buddhist temple in town. I found it. It was just starting out. It was from a Korean Zen lineage. I never even heard of Korean Zen. And I began practicing and learning Zen meditation with this group, which is still there. They've expanded. They're called the Zen Buddhist Temple Ann Arbor. And I got in on pretty much the ground floor of that group right after they purchased their own temple building, which was an old house. And the more I practiced and was with that tiny community as it began to grow, the more I realized that this was my path, that this was my opportunity to at least go towards some kind of spiritual resolution of the questions that had been torturing me ever since third grade, and which basically I had to solve. I knew I just had to resolve these spiritual matters for myself, and that is why I think it was May and June of 1983, I did divest myself of all of my meager possessions. That was a requirement of going into this temple as a resident, and I moved into Zen Buddhist Temple Ann Arbor as a full-time resident and trained there as a Zen student.
And from my understanding, that began a journey into this whole path, and I'm curious, how did the ensuing time period support your growth? And I don't even know what happened after then.
A lot. So this is, I'm on my timeline, we're in my late 20s now. And along the way, I had been married. After I finished undergraduate work, I married a very, very wonderful person who, in fact, died this past summer at the age of 90. So much was quite a bit older than I, however, very young in heart. And he was a professor of French language and literature at Oberlin College. He was not my teacher, I hasten to add. I had never taken any courses with him. He was a survivor of the Holocaust or Shoah in France. He, I think most of his family, including his mother and father, died in Auschwitz and in the concentration camps. And so he had been able to escape and come to the United States, and where, in fact, he was promptly drafted into the U.S. Army, not knowing any English. So there was a story, and he has written his life story, and he has published it. And so, again, we see just in a very instinctive way how I constantly gravitated towards people and situations in which these giant themes of war, of cruelty, of destruction, as well as of hope and of a society in which does help people, which does help people to cross over into freedom, into saving their lives, into fostering their growth, that does happen, those giant contradictions. So Matisse and I had been married, and then that marriage ended after a few years, simply really because I was in an ongoing existential crisis from third grade on, and it was really gaining steam. So that's what led me to say, all right, I've got to go to graduate school and at least get my MFA in writing to take the next step. And then from there, I thought, no, this is not going to work. I need to figure out my spiritual path, and then that will forward me into the Zen Buddhist Temple in Ann Arbor, Michigan. So I trained there as a full-time resident under a vow of poverty. I helped to build that temple from 1983 through 1985, and that brought up even more questions for me about creating the society in which we wish to live. So there are two tracks there, and one track was our meditation practice, in which we did a lot of meditation, constant meditation, as well as a lot of work, which is Zen. It's manual work, service to the community, and Zen meditation. We did a lot of all of those things. And so my spiritual growth was proceeding, and I was going deeper and deeper into my practice, as people say. Well, at the same time, within this temple, we had a residential core that we lived in a quasi-monastic style, and we had a lot of folks who were our sangha or congregation who were lay people who lived in their own homes and then came to the temple to practice. So we were forming, we had our infrastructure, we had our governance system, we had our mini society, we were a residential community, and it brought up so many questions about, is this viable? Is this a good way to live? Is this the best way to govern ourselves? We were extremely hierarchical. It was a patriarchal model, with the Korean Zen monk master at the top. He was not only the spiritual leader, he was also the bylaws had been legally constructed in such a way that there was a board of directors, which I served on, and the spiritual founding teacher was always going to be the president of the board of directors. And this is true. This was legal, evidently. There was one vote. There was one vote on this, and guess who had it? It wasn't me. So the president, it was constructed, so the president of the board of directors always had the one vote.
So I'm hearing this inquiry into this consistent connection between this inner practice and systems and structures that perpetuate the kinds of social systems that we have in society today.
You absolutely get it.
I'm curious about connecting that to where my familiarity with you goes, which is the East Bay Meditation Center, which you have been a leader of for some time now. And I don't know if it feels all right to you to pivot in that direction, but it seems like there's so many practices that you have learned from what may have not worked in that former life to the way that you've tried to evolve what it means to do inner work now. And I'm just curious if you might want to draw some contrast between.
Well, all I can say is you and I have got to get together for coffee. And I will buy you that coffee because even though we have never met in person, you're just totally getting this. This is amazing and wonderful to me, and I want to thank you very much. Yes, so basically I would say that in my monastic training, and I did end up on a spiritual quest, floundering about as I do, crossing the United States, practicing at various Zen and other Buddhist centers, and eventually my quest led me to the home of my spiritual lineage, which is Korean Zen. I'm Japanese American, and my lineage is Korean, and I was in the monastery there for 8 months, from 1987, right after Thanksgiving, 87, to I came back to San Francisco, flew back to San Francisco in August of 1988, after which I began slowly and painfully returning a long transition to lay life, to being a single mother. I had zero money. I arrived back at the San Francisco airport with my head shaved, dressed in robes, and $15 to my name. And I'm not talking about hidden savings or things somewhere. That was it. I have dealt with desperate poverty throughout my spiritual life, which is why the vow not to burn out and to be sustainable is so vivid for me. And to answer your question and weave all of this together, all of the things that I experienced in my monastic practice and experience, and there were wonderful things, and then there were things that as a citizen of the United States and as a member of my anti-Vietnam War generation, just coming from the background that I do with the social forces that have shaped me, with the women's movement, huge influence on when I was in undergraduate in college. It was really in high swing. All of those monastic experiences in very hierarchical and quite abusive systems that were nevertheless not without their benefits. These are systems that are thousands of years old, and the reason they've lasted for thousands of years is that they do function well, and there are benefits within them on many, many different levels. However, coming from the generation I did, I was to all of the other stuff. I was like, hell no. This is oppressive. I do not want to perpetuate this. I don't want to be the butt of any of this kind of treatment. I am not going to do it. I am not going to do it. And I didn't know what that meant. I just knew I was not going to do it. So fast forward to 11 years ago, and I was living and raising my kid and had remarried to my son's father here in Oakland, and was a member of the Buddhist Peace Fellowship, writing about family life and child raising as socially engaged Buddhist practice. So I was gradually working my way back into Buddhist life and circles in an appropriate way for me as a very committed mother. And I began hearing about this group, which at that point, which was called East Bay Dharma Center, later changed to East Bay Meditation Center. And I heard about this group, and I, in fact, was invited to serve on its board of directors a number of times. And at that point, they didn't even have a space. And I just thought, no, I will not attend endless meetings wrangling over the mission and the vision and the location. I'm not at all interested. So I know you're in Berkeley. This is no offense meant. I was not at all interested if this new group wanted to open a center in Berkeley. I feel there's a lot of great spiritual groups and meditation groups from different lineages, some Buddhists, many not, in Berkeley. I was an Oakland resident. My kid was in the Oakland public schools. I wanted something for Oakland. So in 2006, I believe, there was a decision from the board of directors of the East Bay Meditation Center. I believe they changed their name at that time to EBMC, that it would be located in Oakland. A space, a small storefront on Broadway at 22nd, was rented. And at that point, I was asked for a third time to be on the board of directors, and I said, all right, I commit. So we're really right around the time now of the anniversary of opening our doors on Broadway at 22nd, East Bay Meditation Center. We've since moved to a larger location, still in downtown Oakland. And so last year, at the end of last year, 2016, was our first decade. We did. We had offered programs for 10 years. We're now in our 11th year. And exactly what you said, my commitment and my constant enjoyment, I have just gotten so much joy and happiness out of helping to build East Bay Meditation Center that as a board member, now I'm part-time on staff. I've always been a Buddhist teacher and a Dharma teacher with East Bay Meditation Center. My enjoyment has been that it has, for me, been what I call my, it has been the dream that I've had for many years of being part of a Dharma-based activist community that is trying to create and embody and manifest the values that we are also trying to teach.
And if I could jump in there, my understanding is this place is one of the most rare and unique places in existence around this idea of inner practice. I mean, the New York Times had a large expose on it a couple years back that I remember being quite inspired by. And I'm curious if you could just share some of what makes it unique from an inclusivity, diversity, governance lens that you think, you know, could be lessons for others to learn from.
Thank you so much for asking. Let's see. I always say when I'm talking about East Bay Meditation Center, or EBMC, that we are a Buddhist-based meditation center with focused on diversity and inclusion and social justice. We're Buddhist-based. That what that means is that most of our programs are based in Buddhism, which is a way of life and thought. Most folks know it's not a religion in the traditional sense of it's non-theistic. There are people, Buddhists, who believe and have faith in God and pray, and there are plenty of Christian Buddhists. There are Jewish Buddhists. There are many atheist Buddhists. And also, however, it's not dependent on, there's It does not really posit a creator God nor concern itself with a creator God. It is a way of life and thought in which our actions are extremely important. So we are based in those teachings and practices, our interpretation, our socially engaged interpretation of Buddhism, I should say, as well as we do have programs on indigenous spirituality. We've had interfaith programs, which I've always been part of, and because interfaith dialogue and interfaith action has long been an interest of mine. And we also have many secularized programs of what would be mindfulness meditation and practices for stress reduction, specifically for particularly for people who are involved in social justice organizing and social justice work, and for everyone. And some of the ways in which we are different, I always say East Bay Meditation Center is unique, and we don't want to be. We would like to be a model for many other centers in major, diverse urban areas to take our best practices, to adapt them, to change them, throw out what doesn't work, create or adapt and adopt what does work from any other kinds of social movements or any tools that they can get. We would like to be that kind of incubator for other groups to find their own way to do what we are doing. And so some of the ways in which we're different is that we decided early on we would operate on gift economics. What that means is that unless it's a fundraiser for any East Bay Meditation Center program or meditation group, half-day retreat, class series, any event at our center, no one is ever required to pay a fee, an upfront fee, in order to come through our doors and to hopefully benefit from the teachings and the practices and the community that we offer. So we're totally on a gift economics basis. People are invited to give what they can. And we will be, in 2017, launching a full gift economics initiative in order to continue with the education of our community what gift economics means and how it operates. It is an economic system. It's an alternative system to capitalism. And so for that to work for us, we need to always vigorously be educating our community and inviting people into a deeper understanding of how gift economics works. So that's one way in which we're different from many centers. The other way is that in order to carry out our mission of and vision of what's being called radical inclusivity and diversity and social justice, we actually have infrastructure systems and policies that the Board of Directors has instituted, which our community has understood and supported. Not everyone, because that's diversity. However, enough people that we just keep growing and thriving. So, for instance, in our events, we have some events and programs open only to self-identified people of color or self-identified women of color, self-identified men of color. We have some retreats that are open only to people who self-identify as having depression and anxiety, or to people who have disabilities, chronic illness, chronic pain. Mm. So there are some of our programs that are not open to all. For those programs that are open to all, we have a registration system in which people are invited to self-identify as either a white person or as a person of color and or multiracial person. So those two choices are there the minute you try to register for something at East Bay Meditation Center that requires registration. and thus we're able to keep track of the statistics. And we, for events that are open to all, we require that there be a minimum 40% registration of folks who self-identify as people of color and or multiracial.
So why 40%?
Pardon?
Why 40%?
40% because we felt 50% would be even better, and we didn't think that we could consistently for everything guarantee 50% and still have enough registration, enrollment, to make some of our programs that are open to all a go.
Is there a place? I'm sorry. And I'm curious. So I mean, my sense of it is there's so much more depth here that we could make this entire call about this one topic alone. And I'm curious, for those who want to learn more, is there a place that you'd point them to say, okay, here's where you can dive deeper, even if you don't happen to live in the Oakland area?
Yes. We have just launched, in fact, a new website. And for those of you who go to www.eastbaymeditation, one word, eastbaymeditation.org, for those of you who go to our new website, I immediately apologize for any glitches you will find there. We've just launched it. It was constructed mostly with volunteer work over years. It has taken us years because it's been primarily volunteers, fabulous volunteers, who have put it together, and therefore we're now working on ironing out the problems and troubleshooting what remains to be done to make it really 100% functional. However, it's basically fine as it is. So go to our website, and we have, I believe, a menu tab. I'm not looking at it right now. That might say something like diversity practices, or something about how our registration works, which gives an explanation and a history of why we do things in the way that we do. We know that this does not fulfill everyone's needs. Just to be frank, we have lost some folks who have said, no, I just don't agree with that. However, what we have found is that it is not enough. It's not nearly enough to say what basically all other 501c3 religious organizations in the United States will say and are required to say, and most of them mean it, and that is, we are open to all, and we welcome everyone who would like to try out this particular spiritual path and this community. We have an open door. We're welcome to everyone. That is not nearly enough, we have found, because since we do live in a society that does have dominant groups, we do live in a society in which there is not equal levels of power and privilege. What could easily happen is that one or more of the dominant groups of our society, those folks could have come to East Bay Meditation Center and said, wow, what a fabulous place. It's run on gift economics. So whatever my level of income is, I can afford to come here. I love it here. The people are so nice. These are wonderful people. And then those dynamics, which may seem invisible to some, do not at all seem invisible to people in groups that are targeted for oppression in our society. Then just this would not be due to evil people saying we're going to come to this meditation center and oppress other people. It doesn't work like that. We're talking about embedded structural oppression systems, as exactly as you were saying, in which we could easily, without these policies, practices, this vigilance, this awareness, we could easily have become a meditation center in which pretty much everyone would be the member of one of the dominant groups of our society. And that is not our mission. That is not our mission at all. We are solely dedicated to serving underrepresented communities.
I much appreciate that share. Sorry, did I hear Rahul's voice?
Yeah, I too. Thank you so much, Michelle, for sharing that. I just wanted to remind folks on our call that we have a Q&A that's open. We're just about at the top of the hour, and so if you'd like to ask a question, go ahead and press star 6 on your phone to get added in the queue, or you can also email your question to ask@servicespace.org. And I know you've got more questions, Bridger, so I will turn it over to you as we wait for those questions to roll in.
Thank you so much, Rahul. I have so many areas that come up from the richness of this dialogue. There's probably two areas that I'd really love to touch on, Mushim, if it's something that feels in your flow to dive more into. Of course, you know that the theme of today's call focuses on burnout, and I'm just curious about, given your perspective on this mixture between contemplative practice and doing work in the world, where is it that you see the opportunity and the need for dialogue on burnout? And I'm also curious, I mean, EBMC is one of the things that you do, but you have your own leading edge. And I'm just curious if you could even briefly speak to what is most alive for you now in your work.
Thanks very much for that invitation. I am fortunate enough to be the guiding teacher of a year-long program at East Bay Meditation Center called Practice in Transformative Action. And the acronym for that is PITA, Practice in Transformative Action, or PITA, like pita bread. And we're now in our fourth cohort that began meeting together in September. So we go September through July. This is my fourth cohort, and it is secular mindfulness for agents of change and social justice activists. And as I was contemplating, after many years of being a socially engaged Buddhist writer and practitioner, and I thought to myself, and as a community activist, active mainly in the Oakland public schools that my kid went to, as well as in other spheres of Buddhist activity in the United States, issues of race, racism, the other isms, and I thought, well, what is it that I can most offer to these wonderful people in my year-long program who are all agents of change and who are all social justice activists? And because if mindfulness meditation practice simply becomes kind of another thing on their list of things to do to make the world a better place, it will only add to their sense of burden and then be a factor of burnout. Mm. And I clarified early on that what I saw as the major danger for agents of change and social justice activists in the circles I'm in the Bay Area, which is quite active, but also internationally and beyond, because the internet, it's easy to be part of many wonderful groups who are working on causes around the world. What I saw is we need tools to address and prevent burnout, and we need to go to the root of it. We need to ask ourselves why, if there are things that we can do to not burn out, why we're not doing them. What is this momentum and this compulsion to burn out that I have seen very widely in my early activist work? And there was just kind of a whole period earlier in my life where being an activist meant martyring yourself for the cause. Burnout was expected, and everyone was expected to work themselves into the ground and always be unable to make rent. And, you know, if you had kids, God bless you, because no one knew how you were going to be able to raise them unless you inherited family money.
Hmm.
So what I did was I formulated and invite everyone to take the what I call the Great Vow for Mindful Activists. And this was published in an article, I Vow Not to Burn Out, in Buddha Dharma magazine in the fall 2006 issue. And to my amazement, this has gone modestly, maybe I wouldn't even say this has gone viral. There are now, and it was published on the Lion's Roar website, that's the larger organization that publishes Buddha Dharma magazine. It was published online with some great artwork, and I have been getting reports that people around the world are taking the vow to not burn out, which goes like this. Aware of suffering and injustice, I, Mushim, so you can insert your own name if you want to take the vow, which you don't have to, I, Mushim, am working to create a more just, peaceful, and sustainable world. I promise, for the benefit of all, to practice self-care, mindfulness, healing, and joy. I vow to not burn out. And because in order to not burn out, for people who are passionately committed to social justice, for whatever many, many reasons, for the liberation of their own families, their own communities, as well as being able to share the benefit of that work with communities that we're not directly part of, that we're allied to. For instance, we need to have, I feel, such a strong intention to not burn out and to build a community in which people, our friends, will say to us, you know, hey, you said you weren't going to burn out, and I see you on the path to burnout. You're so much on the path to burnout that you are not even able to step back from your own situation and see that you're going to ruin your own health and well-being, and in the process, you'll be ruining our health and well-being because you're our friend and we love you and we care about you. An intervention of sorts. So why put our friends into the position where they feel they need to do an intervention, which is very unpleasant and doesn't always work? We ourselves can do our own mindfulness intervention and say, okay, I have vowed to not burn out on a daily basis, get up in the morning and say, what am I going to do today to both achieve my goals, go in the direction of my goals of helping to build a more just and loving and caring society and sustainable world, and not burn out? All of that together, what's my personal plan for today?
I'm really grateful that you were able to at least touch on this piece, and now that we have the context of where it's coming from in your own background, I'm just so grateful that you shared with us the spectrum of at least a piece of your journey. And I just want to share that at this stage, we'll kind of be transitioning a bit to invite others into this dialogue as well. But I'm just grateful that you provided this overview to us.
Thank you very much. And once again, if folks are interested in this, you can read the full essay I wrote on lionsroar.com, I think. But just Google it, I Vow Not to Burn Out, with my name, Mushim, M-U-S-H-I-M, and you will find it.
Mushim, this is Rahul. I love that. It sounded like the starting point of the framework around the vow to not burn out was to include community. So I just found that to be so beautiful. And again, wanted to invite the community of listeners online and both who have dialed in to press *6 to get into the queue. We do have a couple of questions that have already rolled in from the online chat, which is available at ask@servicespace.org. And the first one is from Jackie Farley, who says, hello, Mushim. So glad that you're offering this opportunity to share tools to avoid burnout. Now, at age 66, I'm just beginning to get a clue about my own propensity to overdo it. And I've decided it's a form of greed because it makes me feel so good working for what I believe in. However, at a certain point, I've noticed that my zeal becomes counterproductive and I crash and burn. So what do I do? And she answered her own question a little bit, but I would love to hear just a little bit more around what your answer to that question would be, how to avoid that burnout.
Thanks. Well, first I'll say, hi, Jackie. Jackie is one of my oldest friends, a wonderful Zen practitioner. So, hi, Jackie. It's great to see your own analysis, because I think you've done it. That we can be greedy about anything. Oftentimes, the word greed is associated with greed for so much money, and we're going to screw everyone over in the process. However, or greed for, you know, just getting all this stuff and hoarding it, and then that's going to be an evil act. However, we can be greedy from the Buddhist point of view for good things. We can be greedy to help others. We can be greedy to get enlightened and be a benefit to all beings. Greed itself can take many different forms, and so the greed to that results in the greed to do more and more things, the greed to say, this is such a good thing and a good cause, I think I'll sign up for 3 other causes. And then suddenly I'm up at 3 in the morning and I'm angry at my family, and you know, I haven't gotten my car maintenance, and so that's going to cause me problems, and my life starts to fall apart, which makes me even angrier and more irritable. That path of greed is what we need to look at in order to assess one of the great questions that is not a Buddhist question. It's a question for all of us on planet Earth now, and that is the question of how much is enough? So the question of enoughness. How much is enough for me to be happy? How much is enough for me to be of help to the world? How much is enough for me to meditate? How much is enough for me to be watching Netflix? That question of enoughness, of balance, of sustainability, and of well-being, that is the great, to use a Zen word, koan, I believe, of the work that we're doing.
I love that, the concept of finding one's personal sufficiency and then only working at a place that is allowing one to maintain that. Beautiful. We also have a comment on the web from David Doan, who says, he's sort of responding to his own answer. He says, being in the present, in other words, his own response to how not to burn out. So he says, being in the present, relaxing, and responding honestly and openly to what is happening, staying away from expectations and predictions, focusing on process and not outcome, being clear about what I'm responsible for and what I'm not responsible for. So those are some of the tools that help him. We also have someone on the line who's Star 6, and so I'm going to go to that question.
Oh, hi, it's Elisa.
Hi, Elisa.
Hi, Rahul. Good morning. Good morning, Misham.
Good morning.
So I was in your practice in transformative action in year 2, and totally, I actually fought you on the vow to not burn out, but eventually took it after I reconciled what it meant. So thank you for that piece of coaching. To me, Musim, it's made a real difference in my life. Because I noticed when I was presented with that vow, it seemed so lovely. You know, like, it seems so simple, and it's actually not simple necessarily, especially if you're feeling just a profound amount of urgency in the world and all of the issues that are happening on our collective watch. And the need that I often feel to address those. But I just so appreciate the balance that the vow to not burn out affords. But that was my comment. And then I have a question that may sound sort of silly, but, you know, in the sort of social and political place that we find ourselves in, and environmental, I mean, with all of the things happening in the world, I'm just going to ask it this way. Do you think we're doomed as humanity?
Thanks, Elisa. So what I'm hearing you saying is considering what we know, and of course we're all perceiving things differently. However, there are certain bodies of information and knowledge. So considering what we know about our situation, nationally, politically, as well as globally, politically and environmentally, and other spheres of under perception and analysis as well. So considering all of this, are we doomed? What do you mean by doomed?
I sort of asked it in a general way, and maybe to be slightly funny, but also Do you think that we as collective humanity have a chance to survive? Like, do you feel hopeful in these times? And what gives you hope? Maybe that's a better, more positive way to frame the question. Do you feel hopeful, and what gives you hope? And on the flip side, do you have any sense of impending doom, or how do you grapple with that?
Thanks. That's actually a really good question, I feel. If you've been listening in, you've undoubtedly noticed that I've felt doomed since I was in third grade. So that the whole doomed thing, and at that point, and then as I was growing up, we were always doomed. I mean, we were always doomed, Elisa. I remember when I was in college, there was a whole movement called ZPG, or Zero Population Growth. And people were asked to consider that if they had children, they should only have a one, like if you had a family with two parents in it, that you should only have a maximum of two children. In other words, that there should be an attempt worldwide not to increase the population of human beings on the planet. And there was this whole doom scenario of how we're overpopulating the planet and we're all going to go down in flames and the planet will be all ruined and everything like that. So that you add on to the Cold War narrative that I grew up under, where Russia was going to nuke us, and then there was going to be environmental disaster because of pesticides, and keep rolling forward until today, where we have global climate change, which, by the way, I do believe in, we are definitely doomed. We are totally doomed, and as far as I can see, human beings have done this to ourselves. The Buddhist analysis is out of greed, hatred, and ignorance or delusion, and those are the roots of suffering. And we're causing a lot of suffering, obviously, not only to human beings, but to other living beings and to the planet itself, to the waterways, to the earth, to the air. Almost inconceivable, yet we're being asked to conceive it and to do something about it. So in the midst of all of this doom and a great deal of gloom, do I feel hopeful? Yes, I feel very hopeful. And I feel functional hope, and I feel practical hope, because I don't have any other choice. I am the mother of an only child who is going to turn 28 in April. As I mentioned, he is a product of the Oakland Public Schools, K-12, in which there's a lot of activist story there, as well as all of the themes we've been talking about of inequity and poverty and racism, and all of those are playing out in our public education systems, lack of budget for the kids. The reason that I'm hopeful is because unless there is hope that manifests in practical actions to help one another, then the only other alternative is to be passive and to say, well, since this ship is going down, I'm just going to try to be personally comfortable myself as much as possible and wait to go down with it. I don't think that's even viable, that's useful. As human beings, it's been remarked upon by Dr. Bessel van der Kolk, who's one of the leading experts on trauma these days, that the hallmark of what makes a healthy human being, a functioning human being, is that we need a sense of purpose. We need a profound sense of purposefulness, which is what is often damaged in trauma, due to just being crushingly, overwhelmingly, uncontrollably abused and traumatized, or traumatized by some disaster that's beyond our control. Human beings can feel a sense of purposelessness, like, well, what's the use of going on? And then there's a kind of an inner collapse and despair. I don't want to live like that. I can't live like that. And have been a mother, have been a spiritual practitioner. There's got to be a direction in which I can go. And so a lot of my own cultivation of my practice has been to say that we hold both of these things. I hold both of these things simultaneously. We can hold multiple realities. On one hand, yes, we're doomed. And on the other hand, yes, I am profoundly hopeful.
I love that. It seems like if it would be fair to summarize, it's almost that there is no useful choice but to be hopeful.
That's what I think.
Yeah, beautiful. Elisa, I know you had several other questions that you sent online. I wonder if you wanted to ask those or if you wanted to, if we want to move on to a different question.
Oh, thank you. No, they all got answered.
Okay, wonderful. Well, so absolutely. I'm curious, Mushim, you know, you were talking about kind of this this narrative around doom came up, and I'm very curious about how your spiritual practice informs your understanding of narrative. I mean, we heard that hope is the only useful functional option, but there's something about understanding that it's one thing to sort of create a new story and another force that recognizes that any story is just that, which is a story. So how does your kind of spiritual practice reconcile the tension between these opposites?
Tell me what the opposites are again.
Well, just that, you know, you've worked consistently, I think, in kind of redefining narrative, and you've had this narrative also of doom since the third grade. And, you know, all of these are really just narratives in a way. And I think spiritual practice is one thing that has the potential to help us see that regardless of the story that we're telling ourselves, it is simply a story. So I wonder if that's an interesting tension for you or a question that's come up, or do you feel like we have to actually invest in one story and sort of more fully own it?
You know, that's a many-layered question. So what I will say about that, I think that whether we have to invest in and fully own one narrative over others is, I think that to me is sort of a moot question. I think that most human beings, myself included, to make sense of our lives, we do form a dominant narrative. And that's, of course, going to be challenged, and that's going to be, and that hopefully will change and evolve. However, there's usually a kind of a dominant narrative, like this is who I am, this is what I stand for, these are the people and causes I stand with, this outrages me, this not so much because of my culture, because of my generation, so on and so forth. So there is that narrative, and in the way that I was trained in Zen meditation, something that I've really thought about a lot, or not thought a lot about a lot and experienced, is that my original teacher, Zen Master Samu Sinam, I remember once said to us as students, he said, meditation is entering timeless time. Timeless time. And I
said, can you say that again? Meditation is what?
It's entering timeless time.
Huh. Okay.
So meditation is entering timeless time, time that has no time. You know, you're getting the Zen flavor there. And I mean, Zen people are always saying those kinds of exasperating things. Well, how can you have time that's timeless? And then, of course, the answer to that is go find out. So my experience and understanding of what that means is that when we're in the flow of the deeper concentrative levels of meditation in the Buddhist tradition, so that might be called samadhi in the Theravada or Southern tradition. There are various levels of deeper meditative concentration called the jhanas. So whatever name we have for them, there's going to be a common human physiology that researchers are now hooking meditators up and measuring brain waves and things that are going on in our bodies and finding, breaking it down quantitatively. So that's very interesting, the new neuroscience of meditation. So whatever the readings might be on whatever you're hooked up to, I know from personal experience that experience exactly of in a state of contemplative or meditative concentration, that experience of being in a sense of timelessness where there's no beginning, there's no middle, there's no ending, there's no, as Thich Nhat Hanh's folks have a song, they sing, there's no after, there's no before, that those reference marks completely drop away and there is a new and a different way of being that is often perceived as being profoundly liberative, profoundly open and refreshing and transformative. And so you were talking about the opposite. So there's this timeless time, and then there's the narrative of doom. The narrative of doom, obviously, is a linear narrative. It is a timeline on which presumably there was a state in which things were better or were okay, were not doomed, and then there were causes and conditions that is leading, in this case, the planet or societies, down some kind of path of other things happening with an overwhelming momentum, and then on that timeline, at the far right end, like in the left end, there is the word, you know, there's the non-doomed state, and then everything's rolling along in a linear fashion, and then at the far end, there's doom and destruction, and that's the end, the F-I-N. So these are, if you're pointing out, these are polarities, or these are different aspects of our human experience and our capacity for human experience, and I believe that both are needed, that we don't necessarily have to go around like Chicken Little saying we're doomed and the sky is falling. However, to have a sense of purpose and of working in a linear way towards trying to build this compassionate society, which is the goal of Service Space and of so many other the work that good folks are doing. So there is that sense of linear life and purposefulness and being goal-directed, being strategic, and at the same time, unless, in my opinion, we have through our spiritual lives, whatever practices we do, this experience essentially that we always have access to timeless time in which everything is so different. The array of sun that comes through, I'm experiencing it right now, coming through my front windows, I feel it on my cheeks, I feel it on my forehead, that in this moment, there is so much contentment, there's so much radiance, there's so much gratitude for this gift that we do call being an alive person in the world right now, that all of this is absolutely true simultaneously.
I love that answer. And I feel like this call itself has been very much in line with your description of timeless time, which you called open, refreshing, and transformative. So thank you so much, Misheng, for joining us. It's my privilege to ask the final question that we ask all of our guests, which is how can we, as the broader service-based community, support your work?
The answer to that is very easy. You, as the larger service-based community, can support the work that I'm doing by not burning out.
Beautiful.
And in fact, doing the opposite. Not only not burning out, also thriving, loving your life, living your life in such a way that you're able to share joy, healing, hope, transformation, and practical tools and strategies, as well as just that human element of knowing that we can and will do this work together. If you can do that in your own way, that is what will support me.
I am smiling so largely from your answer. Thank you so much for that. We are now going to invite everyone on the call to hold a collective minute of silence. And after that moment of silence, and this time it's actually in gratitude instead of from a place of grounding ourselves, but we'll just ground ourselves into that gratitude. And then after that, I'm going to unmute everyone who's dialed in, and we'll have a collective opportunity to thank Mishim for being with us. So just a minute of silence. Thank you all. We are now all unmuted, and so on the count of three, let's all just say thank you, Mishim, and then whatever else we'd like to express for our gratitude. All right, let's go. One, two, three. Thank you, Mishim.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to a recording of Awaken Calls. To access archives, visit us at www.awaken.org. And to get more involved, volunteer at www.servicespace.org.